Hey, Snappers, listen. That right there, that's the sound of no beat. Understand, the clock is ticking. We're raising money to keep Snap Judgment Storytelling alive, and I'm asking Snappers everywhere to step up. If storytelling with a beat rocks your weekend, your commute, your exercise, your morning, or your mind, support this program before it's too late. You decide what it's worth to you. We've got just a few days to make this work, or it will not happen unless you make it happen. Donate at snapjudgment.org right now. We're going to do our part with amazing sponsors to help pay these bills. Be sure you do your part as well. Bring back the beat. Support our Kickstarter at snapjudgment.org. Thanks. Snap Judgment is supported by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website, portfolio, and online store. For a free trial and 10% off, visit squarespace.com and enter the offer code SNAP at checkout. Now, maybe you're like me, not so technically minded, but it's us that need a great-looking website even more than the computer nerds. Am I right? I'm right. So customize your own beautiful design. It's so easy, it's drag and drop easy. Plans start at $8 a month. They include a free domain name if you sign up for a year. And every site comes with an online store so you can sell your swag right away. Start a trial with no credit card required and begin building your website today. When you decide to sign up for Squarespace, use the offer code SNAP to get your 10% discount off your first purchase. Squarespace. A better web starts with your website. Snappers, I am so excited for you to hear this. Last week, we gave you a taste of Snap Live storytelling magic, but this week, dinner is served. From PRX and NPR, we proudly present Snap Judgment, the finale. Ushers are standing by, making sure the aisles are clear. We join Snap Live. Already in progress.
Now, next up, we've got a guy who travels the world telling poems. He's a poet. But I asked him none of that. Today, come tell us a story poetically. I proudly introduce Mighty Mike McGee.
When I was 9 years old, I believed in magic. Not a kid's cartoon utopia where Muppets, Smurfs, Autobots, unicorns all live in a hidden castle made of Legos. Although that sounds awesome. No, I was a realist. I longed for a more natural magic. One in which all the knowledge of the universe could be revealed if all of the right elements were put in place in the proper setting. Now, I had heard in school about two things that sounded very magical. One was Halley's Comet, and the other was the birds and the bees. All my friends were itching to ask their dads about that one. I figured maybe this was the magic I was looking for. Suddenly, I was sent to live with my father, my army father, on an army base in Fort Lee, Virginia. The decision to send me to live with my father gutted my mother, but it had been decided through the courts that I should stay with him for a year. Plus, living on an army base would save us a bit of money in medical bills because of my condition. My condition is spina bifida. It's a spinal birth defect that usually comes with a variety of complications. And I figured living with my dad could be kind of cool, and maybe he would be able to clue me in on even a part of the magic that is the birds and or the bees. In Virginia, I met my new stepmother and baby brother and immediately launched into a campaign to find out more about the birds and the bees. The first real father-to-son conversation I thought I was about to have with my dad, I asked him to tell me about it. He vetoed it immediately, saying that I was just a little too young for that topic. This just further mystified the subject for me. My father, being a military policeman, worked very long hours at the police station. So I just sort of hid out in my bedroom, watched the sky for Halley's Comet, listened to the radio. Fort Lee left very little for me to believe in. One morning, I woke up and I went to tie my shoes. And when I bent over, an electric jolt of pure pain shot through my spine to my brain, becoming an instant migraine. I asked my stepmother for aspirin, then I did again the next day and the day after. She grew concerned and alerted my father. The local army clinic decided that I needed more advanced treatment 3 hours north in Washington, D.C. Because my appointments were very early in the morning, this created an opportunity for my father and I to take long road trips together overnight so that he could get back in time to report for duty in the afternoons at Fort Lee. The first real conversation I finally had with my father was on our first drive to D.C., him looking ahead down the road, me looking easterly out the window for Halley's Comet. Dad, have you ever seen a comet?
I don't think so, son. But I'm pretty sure I saw a UFO once.
What? No way! My dad smiled, cracked the window, lit an unfiltered Camel cigarette, and launched into a long explanation on UFOs. Then he launched into another great story. Then I told him a story. We traded into the night. I couldn't understand, though, why comets weren't these giant, unavoidable, obvious fireballs of death zigzagging across the sky, scaring the crap out of everybody. That would have made my job a lot easier. CAT scans, MRIs, spinal taps, overnight stays. My father took every chance he could to sleep in a cot next to my hospital bed. The doctors would check me out and then ask my dad to come speak with them very seriously in the hallway while I got dressed. On the way home, one of the last drives home, my father explained to me that I had a tethered spinal cord. It was fusing to my vertebrae. If I moved in the wrong way or had a growth spurt, it could tear, and I would most definitely be paralyzed. So they had to operate very soon. I could still be paralyzed, but I could also die. So, my father and I made that last drive to DC for my operation. He was scared, and he became overly sentimental. And he mistakenly offered me an opportunity to ask him anything I wanted to know about life. Anything?
Anything.
The birds and the bees?
I only paused so I wouldn't sound as eager as I actually was. The dude left his guard down, right? Okay, son. When a man and a woman love each other very, very much, let's go back a little bit. You know that men have a penis, obviously, and women have the vagina. It's like a glove. It's glove-like. And when a man loves her very, very much, and only when he loves her, he places his...
Wait, Dad.
Yes. Is this about sex? Yes. The birds and the bees is about sex? Yes. Oh. Well, Mom told me all about that when I was 5. Well, now why'd she go and do that? Because I asked her where babies come from, and she said sex, and then she told me exactly how to do sex, and now I know everything about sex. Well, now, hold on. Not everything. It gets more complicated as you get older, so if there are any details you need filled, you can go ahead and ask me. The car grew very quiet and awkward for a long moment. Wait, son. What was it exactly you thought the birds and the bees was about? I don't know. I just kind of hoped it was about magic. Like, every kid gets an opportunity to go on a journey by themselves, all alone. Their dad hands them a bird and their mom hands them a bee. And then they drop them off at the forest with a snack. And then the kid goes in the forest alone and they look for an ancient log and then they stand on the log and then they introduce the bird to the bee. And if they kiss, then the clouds part and the sky opens up and all of the knowledge of the universe rains down on the log. They don't have to stay on the log, but they're allowed to catch however much knowledge they can carry. And that's why there's smart people, and that's why there's dumb people. That's a way better reason, son. Now, son, I need you to understand this surgery you're about to go and have is pretty dangerous. There's a lot of risk involved, and I think you're pretty brave for going through with it. And I want you to know that I love you so much. And that no matter what happens to you, I'm going to be there for you all the way through it. Dad, could I die? Hold on, Michael. And he pointed to the needle on the gas gauge. We pulled off the highway into a gas station where he refilled the tank, his coffee, and his cigarettes. This was the event of a lifetime for me right then and there. Instead of watching the sky for a deadbeat that only comes around every 76 years, I watched my 28-year-old father step out of that gas station, light a cigarette, sip his coffee, and stare at the sky in a very familiar way. Hallie should have been nearby, but my father was right there for me, sacrificing sleep, his career, his paycheck for me, searching the sky for a promise that I would live. Spoiler alert, I totally did. But he also looked for a guarantee that I wouldn't be paralyzed. But I was. I was paralyzed for a while after the operation. But back at that moment, at that gas station, under the stars, in the middle of nowhere, my father had no idea when my comet would come and if I would even live to see it.
So he put out his cigarette, came back to the car, got inside, and he looked right at me. "Michael, it's gonna be okay." "Really?" "Yeah, it is." My father didn't get any hard answers from the stars that night, but what he did get was hope. And apparently, hope is just a word grown-ups use for magic. So I did the only thing I could do, the one thing we both needed me to do. I believed him.
Mighty Michael McGee.
Yes, for a short time only, you can see this performance in all of its majesty for free at snapjudgment.org. Tell your friends, tell your enemies, because you're cool like that. Now, when Snap Judgment returns, a powerful story from a young girl standing on the edge of a very high cliff. Don't go anywhere. Snap Judgment, live. All right, Snappers, the clock is ticking. We need your support, but know that when you give to Snap, Snap gives back. Get your Snap Judgment t-shirt, get Snap VIP tickets, get Snap swag, and let your Snap flag fly high. Donate now to the Snap Judgment Kickstarter campaign at snapjudgment.org. Thanks. Snap Judgment is supported by GoToMyPC. You've got a lot of work to do and a lot of places to go. What you don't have is time in the office to get caught up on everything. Luckily, GoToMyPC goes where you go, so you can work from anywhere, whether you're traveling, bouncing between appointments, or home after hours. GoToMyPC by Citrix gives you secure access to your entire office computer, wherever you are, from any internet-connected computer, tablet, or smartphone. You can edit or send any file, use any program, just as if you were sitting at your desk. But you don't want to sit at your desk. Be virtually at work from anywhere. Coffee shops, airports, hotels, restaurants, the beach. It's easy to use and sets up in minutes. You don't need to be at the office to get work done. You just need GoToMyPC. Try it free for 30 days. Download the free app, then visit GoToMyPC.com and click the Try It Free button. That's GoToMyPC.com. Try it free today. Welcome back to Snap Judgment Live, the finale, already in progress. A brief note, our next story does contain references to sex, drugs, and rock and roll. As such, sensitive listeners and those with small children are advised. Now, our next guest, we are so thrilled to welcome. That's right, give her some love, Miss Lena Mesitsis.
Daddy comes home with a brand new silver Volkswagen Beetle, and there's a single rose affixed to the steering wheel. It's the summer of my 16th birthday, so I'm thinking, okay, I'm gonna go back to school with a car. Dad calls the whole family out to the driveway, turns to my mother. He says, "This is for you, Maria, for our silver anniversary." It's also the summer of my parents' 25th. It's not my car. My mother says, "What? For me? You stupid, I had no idea." My father's always been one for the Hallmark holidays, and so when it comes time to celebrate his wife, he celebrates with a brand new car. My mother celebrates by going to Greece without him. Mom's always going back to Greece. It's always been the drill. She's homesick for the country she left 25 years ago. She says she's going to Lesbos, a small island off the coast of mainland. She says she's going to visit her family. But when she comes back, something is different. My father calls me out to the dining room. He's seated across the table from my mother. Obviously, something is serious. He says, "Lina, your mother has met someone in Greece. We don't know what's going to happen." What? Like a boyfriend? Yes, like a boyfriend. I start to cry. The boyfriend lives on Lesbos. He called my family once. It was 6 months ago. Greece had just won the Euro Cup. He asks to speak to my mother. And amidst all of the shouting and the hugging and the high-fiving, my mother goes into the kitchen so she can hear what he's saying. And I'm thinking, who is this guy and why is he calling my family? Doesn't he have his own family? Suddenly, my mother speaks up. "Why are you crying?" she says. "You don't care about this at all." And it's not a very mom thing to say, but she's also not wrong. I mean, I'm sad that my dad is sad, but I'm also thinking about all of the stuff I can get away with if my mom goes back to Greece. I mean, forget the carryout I'm gonna have for dinner every night. I can invite boys into my bedroom and no one's gonna notice. I can smoke pot out the bedroom window and my dad doesn't even know what it smells like. I stop crying. A week later, they call me out to the dining room for a second time. This is the last time. And my father says, "Lina, your mother is moving to Greece to be with her boyfriend." And finally, my mother has something to say. She says, "When you can drive, you can have the Volkswagen." I am delighted. The move is eerie. My mother goes back and forth between tearful packing and elated phone calls with the boyfriend on the island. She tells me, "Lina, I know this is hard, but he is very excited for me to come." She says it to me like I'm her friend and we're at a bar and it's a secret. I am so embarrassed for my father. Mama's gone by the time I get my license. It's Halloween. It's a big night of firsts for me. It's my first time driving the Silver Bug alone. It's my first time driving on a freeway. It's my first time going to Christian's house. He's 27. He's a server at the restaurant where I'm a carryout girl, and so I am wearing stiletto heels for the occasion. I park the Silver Bug. I walk up to his door. I knock. He lets me in. He offers me mushrooms, and I take them. And suddenly, I am hallucinating, and the refrigerator is singing to me, and the coffee table is biting me, and there's a Keebler elf blowing kisses at me. Right before I have sex with Christian for the first time, I say, "Do you know how old I am?" "No." He's lying. "I'm 16. "Well, it's okay with me if it's okay with you." At 3 a.m., I tell Christian that I think I might be in love with him. And at 3:01, my father calls. "Where are you, Lina? Why are you doing this to me right now, Lina?" I get into the silver bug to drive home, but I'm still high. And the road is made of butter. And the butter is melting. I pull over the car. I call my dad back. Daddy, I need you to come pick me up. I'm behind the Krispy Kreme on Route 1. He's there 30 minutes later. I'm curled up in the fetal position in the back seat. Neither of us says a whole lot as we drive home. But as I watch the federal office buildings vibrating out the car window, he does say one thing. You have to be home by midnight. That's it. No punishment, no inquiry, nothing. Just a curfew. A week later, I'm back in the silver bug. I am driving home from school. I am texting Christian from behind the wheel. I blast right through a stop sign. And I crash the silver VW bug into a fire truck. The fire truck is fine. Me? I'm fine. My parents' car? Smashed to hell. Now, I used to love telling this story about how I went and ruined the symbol of my parents' failed marriage. But it doesn't end there. My mother calls back. My father picks up the phone from the bedroom, and I pick up and listen in from the living room. All I hear is, I want to come back to America. I want to come home. My father says that they're going to get marriage counseling. He says it's going to be okay. We're going to get through this. But when she flies back, I don't go to the airport to meet her, and I don't say hi to her when I come home from school. I resist. I go to work. I kiss Christian in the utility closet at work because, turns out, he does care that I'm 16 and he doesn't want anyone to know about me. After work, I party with the busboys and the servers, and by now they're selling me baggies of cocaine on the weekends. It's my mother who figures out what I'm up to. She finds little razors and cut-up straws hidden all around my bedroom, and when she confronts me, I deny it. You lie. I read your diary. I'm going to call the police. You're hurting us. Oh, us? What us? You left us. Suddenly, I'm the one damaging our family? My mother puts me in rehab. I'm 16, and I am the problem, the project, and the focus. My parents don't get their marriage counseling because they're using that money instead on my recovery. At my rehab's recommendation, my parents go to anonymous meetings, and they listen to other kids and other kids' parents tell horrifying stories of rock bottom and worst case. And my father tells me, you know, Lina, there were prostitutes in those meetings. And my mother says, well, Lina, at least you didn't do that. And the VW bug, the anniversary car, it sits totaled in front of my parents' house until I'm out of rehab. And when I get out, they sell it. Now they have a brand new house. They have two matching Toyota Corollas. And they're even growing a vegetable garden together in their backyard. And this summer, when my mother asked if she could go to Greece for the first time in 10 years, my father said, it's okay. I trust you. You know, when parents split up, they tell their kids, honey, it is not your fault. We are not doing this because of you. And in my family, it wasn't my fault that my parents split up. but it was my fault that they stayed together.
Rock and roll.
Now then, if you are drinking milk, please finish it right now. Because when Snap Judgment Live returns, we can't be held responsible for what goes down which pipe. Snap Judgment, the amazing conclusion in just a moment. Stay tuned.
Support for Snap Judgment comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support for the Snap Judgment podcast comes from Trunk Club, a men's outfitting service focused on simplifying the process of clothes shopping. So it's like you always imagined it could be, just in real life. See, every guy that uses Trunk Club is matched with a personal stylist, someone who gets to know your individual preferences and styles, someone who handpicks a selection of premium clothing, who packs it in a trunk and ships it off to you to try on in the privacy of your own home. No hurry. You get 10 days to try on everything in the trunk. Decide what you like, send the rest back. Shipping is free both ways. With no monthly obligations, let them give you the special Snap treatment. For Trunk Club's clothing discovery service, check out trunkclub.com/snap. That's trunkclub.com/snap. Welcome back to Snap Judgment from PRX and NPR. Remember, you heard this on Snap Judgment, the finale, already in progress.
And now, people call him lots of things, an adventure traveler, a raconteur, a seller out of one-man shows. Here on Snap Judgment, we call him the closer. Put your hands together for Mr. James Judd.
You know, when Glenn asked me to do this show, I was hesitant because I knew that I would have to portray myself as a 10-year-old. And if there are two things I really, really cannot stand, it's adults playing children and children. And then I thought, why not? It's 1975. It's the first Tuesday in June. It's the semifinals of the Foothill Elementary School 5th grade book report competition. And right now, I am this close to being named top 5th grade book reporter. I know, it's huge. Now, picture me at 10. I already stand 5'9" tall. I have a huge head of curly red hair, a pear-shaped body. I'm the type of kid who wears long sleeve shirts and pants even during summer. I'm a nerd, I'm an outcast. But I have convinced myself that when I win this book report competition, it is gonna turn it all around for me. And I am so ready to be part of the in crowd. But there is one person standing between me and victory, and her name is Mary Applebaum. Mary Applebaum is the second most popular girl in the entire 5th grade. Felicia Johnson is the first most popular girl because she already has boobs. But Mary Applebaum is a very close number two, and she's in my class, which means I'm going to have to beat Mary Applebaum today if I'm going to make it to the big show tomorrow. And Mary Applebaum, oh, make no mistake, she wants to win this competition. She thinks she's got the whole thing all wrapped up. I mean, with the other kids, she tries to play it cool. She's like, ah. I don't care. I just think it's really nice that everyone has a chance. Yeah, I'm not buying it. Because I see her for what she is. She is a ruthless competitor. But the fact is, this competition will be won by the person who has picked the biggest and hardest book to read. And true, I don't know what book she's picked. And yes, it worries me. But she doesn't know what book I picked either. Now, I know. I know that I am not cute and perky and good at tetherball and everybody's favorite person like Mary Applebaum, I know. So I know that if I'm gonna win this thing, I need a book that's really big. I need something that's just gonna put me over the hump. I need something edgy, something ripped from the headlines. So the book I've chosen is My Search for Patty Hearst. By Stephen Weed. It's not a random choice. I have been obsessed with a missing 19-year-old newspaper heiress since she was kidnapped about a year ago, not 40 miles from where I was growing up outside of Berkeley, California. And since nobody knows where she's been hiding since she apparently joined the group that kidnapped her and started to help them rob banks around San Francisco, it seems plausible, to me at least, that maybe she is still hiding somewhere in the area. And many times after school, I would take my miniature Dachshund Brownie and we would scour the neighborhood looking for clues. As it turns out, she was hiding in the area. Brownie and I were so ahead of our times. Well, at this point, everyone else in the classroom was taking their shot at this thing except for me and Mary Applebaum, and I don't see any other real threat to my ascension to glory. Well, right now, our fifth grade teacher, Mrs. Husong, beehive, cat eye glasses, scratchy woolly shoes, smells like powder, lots of rings, big clunky shoes, calls Mary to the front of the room. Hi, everyone. My name is Mary Applebaum. You guys! Stop clapping. I haven't won yet. My name is Mary Applebaum. And the book I've chosen for today's semifinals of the Foothill Elementary School 5th Grade Book Report Competition is Little Women by Louisa May Alcott. It's a really good book. Well, I am not gonna lie to you. Mary Applebaum nailed it. I mean, she really nailed it. She had characters on the blackboard. She quoted the book from memory. She said something in French. I don't even know what that was about. She did a little dance. And then she had people singing at the end and people were crying. I mean, she nailed it. Oh my God, she nailed it. Oh my God, she really nailed it. Oh my God. Well, Mary finishes to a thunderous ovation, and Mrs. Husong calls my name. But as I get up to approach the front of the classroom, a teacher from another classroom comes in, and she knocks on the doorway, and she beckons for Mrs. Husong to come out into the hallway and talk to her. And Mrs. Husong says, "Go on, James, just get started without me. I'll be right back." And she's gone. Well, this is not part of my plan. And just as I approach the front of the room, a beam of light bursts through the curtains of the back of the room and lands in a dazzling white pool of light right in front of my feet. And I step into that light and I think, spotlight. So I ask, how many people here have ever been kidnapped? Nobody raises their hands. So I ask, how many people here have ever been locked in a closet? A couple of people raise their hands. I ask for a month and the hands go down. Well, by the time Mrs. Shusong comes back into the classroom, I've already drawn a number of pictures on the blackboard, including all the names of all the major members of the Symbionese Liberation Army, the SLA, the group that kidnapped Patty, Donald DeFries, Nancy Ling Perry, Bill and Emily Harris, you know the rest. Over here is a seven-headed snake, which is the group's trademark and frequent backdrop for publicity photos. Here is a crude layout of the Hibernia Bank where Patty reintroduced herself to the world as a member of the terrorist organization. And here is a stick figure of Patty as she appeared that day, reintroducing herself to the world as Tanya. A tough chick bank robber with a machine gun and a wig with a wavy curl. Well, Mrs. Shusong comes back into the classroom and she stands in the doorway. And I can tell she's discombobulated by the pictures on the blackboard. And by the silence in the room. Because just at that moment, I was having everybody write their own ransom notes. You don't get that in Little Women. Mrs. Shusong says, James, what book have you got there? I say, My Search for Patty Hearst. She says, James, that is completely inappropriate material for the fifth grade. Sit down, I said, but I'm not finished yet. She said, oh, yes, you most certainly are finished. I ought to wash your mouth out for bringing that filth into my classroom. Now, I know that what I said next was wrong. I know that now I know. But you at least have to admire my commitment to the moment. When I turned to my fifth grade teacher as a 10-year-old and said, oh yeah? Well, maybe I should lock you in the supply closet for a month until you start to see things my way. Power to the people! Rise up, my revolutionary brothers and sisters! Get up! Now I know. Well, the principal calls my mother and tells her to come pick me up from work. And my mother is livid. Not because of the book. She gave me the book. But because she hates to be called away from her new part-time job at IBM, where she is becoming something of an expert in the hot new field of word processing. Oh, it was big. The first word processors changed everything. It was a very exciting time to type. My mother helped erase the scourge of liquid paper. Who wouldn't want to be a part of that? Well, she drives our 75 Ford Granada back to our suburban ranch house in a fury. She slams on the brake. I try to sneak out the side door. She says, oh, no, you don't. You're not getting off that easily. Since you're so good at remembering people's names and all the terrible things they do to each other, I have a little job for you to do for me while you're at home today. You do it, And I won't tell your father what happened at school. Well, this was not an offer that I could refuse. I come from something of a strange family. When my parents met, my father was a missionary from Utah. My mother was a cocktail waitress from Las Vegas. I like to tell people I was really the only hard-drinking Mormon in kindergarten that could shoot crabs. A man is lying in the hospital bed. The nurse comes in. She says, I'm going to take your temperature. Would you like an oral thermometer or a rectal thermometer? He says, what's the difference? She says, the taste. The point is, I was a star in need of a gig. So I said to my mother, okay, well, what is it? What do you want me to do? She said, I want you to watch The Young and the Restless for me and tell me what happens. Now, my mother was addicted to soap operas, but now that she had this new part-time job, it was killing her not to know what was happening on her favorite soaps, especially The Young and the Restless. I mean, this was the land of time before time when there were no VCRs or TiVos or DVRs. It wasn't even Betamax at this point, so... You know, it was really killing her not to know what was going on. She says, it comes on at noon, channel 2. You do a good job. And this whole day will be our little secret. So I watched. And wow, what an eye-opener. Later that night, after the rest of my family had gone to bed, my mother comes into my room. She pulls up a chair next to the bed. She turns on my overhead light. She gives me a shake and she says, well... What happened? Lauren was buried alive on the eve of her wedding to Paul by a jealous ex-boyfriend. Is she still alive? Yes. She managed to drill an air hole with a diamond on her engagement ring. And it popped out of the ground just as Paul was walking by. Well, did he dig her up? No. He didn't have a shovel, so he went looking for one. And he ran into Nikki, and Nikki said she had a shovel and she'd give it to him. But then Nikki said that she's in love with Paul too, and she wants him to marry her tomorrow instead of Lauren. And if Paul is okay with that, well then, maybe they should just leave Lauren where she is. Well, what did Paul say? Nothing. He opened his mouth to speak. And then he closed it. And then he opened it. And then he closed it. And then the show was over. Now, I don't know how many of you here watch soap operas, but that's what they do to you. They find some way to get you interested. And then they make you wait and wait and wait and wait for the whole hour until they finally get to the one thing you want to hear someone say. Then they open their mouth to speak and then they close it. Open, close, open, close, open, close, like a fish. And the screen fades to black and you have to wait for a day or a week or a month or forever to find out what it was they were going to say. My mother says, oh, that is a perfect way to drive a person crazy. Okay, you can stay home tomorrow, too. Oh, what the heck? There's only a week left of school. You can skip the whole thing. Well, by the end of that summer, my mother was paying me $1 a day to stay inside and watch her soaps for her and then act them out for her when she gets home from work. Well, needless to say, it was a great summer. It changed me. I learned things watching soaps I could never learn in elementary school. Things like how to walk into a room and cause a scene. I learned that no matter whom you marry, you're always gonna wind up with her sister. I learned how to hold on to a grudge for dear life like it was the last life vest on the Titanic. But the most important lesson I learned watching soaps was that you gotta be ready. You gotta be ready, because if you are, at least once in everyone's life will come one golden, shiny moment when you can emerge from the shadows at a wedding or a funeral or a courtroom and announce to the stunned assembly that, yes, in fact, I am very much alive. Summer ends. It does. I thought it was over. It's not. I keep going. Summer ends, as we all hope this show will one day. Summer ends, I go back to school, and as luck would have it, Mary Applebaum and I are once again classmates. And at the end of the first day of school, we find ourselves alone together in the classroom. Mary is at her usual place at the front of the room. I'm in my usual place at the back of the room. But Mary, while she can sense that something is different about me, something has changed. And she gets kind of kittenish as she puts on her backpack and she says, I just want you to know that I feel really bad about what happened at last year's book report competition. I'm sure you didn't know your book was dirty and bad. Anyway, I guess you also know I won the whole thing. It shouldn't come as any surprise. Little Women wins every year. The trophy looks really nice in my room. From my place at the back of the room, I get up and I begin slowly to approach Mary Applebaum, saying nothing but speaking volumes with my eyes. And I get right in front of her, right in for my close-up. And then I grab her and I kiss her. And when I let go, she kind of swoons for a moment. And then she grabs me and she kisses me back. I think, yes, victory is mine. I may not have won the trophy, but I won the girl who won the trophy. Even if I don't really want her. Good enough for me. And I break our embrace, and I turn and begin to walk quickly out of the room. And just at that moment, Mary Applebaum runs forward. She says, James, wait. James, wait. James. James, wait. Tell me, what about us? And I turn slowly back to Mary Applebaum, look her right in the eye, and in my very best soap opera voice, I say,
good news, that performance, that James Judd performance, we caught it all on tape, and it has to be seen to be truly believed. It's free for a short time only. Peep how Snap Live went down for yourself at snapjudgment.org. Let the world know that you are a snapper. Sport the brand new Snap Judgment t-shirt and be the envy of the wannabes. It's hot. How else will they know you're one of us? Come down and get the Snap VIP backstage passes for our next live show and all kinds of Snap goodies at snapjudgment.org. Brilliantly filmed by the hardest working team in radio. This show was executive produced by Mark Ristich, the Uber producer, and myself. But please give it up. A big round of applause for Will Urbina, Pat Mesiti-Miller, Jasmine Aguilera,
Aurora Soria, Davey Kim, Anna Adlerstein, Eliza Smith, Renzo Gorio, Leon Morimoto, Anna Sussman, Julia DeWitt, Joe Rosenberg, and Nancy Lopez. The music you just heard, every piece, was composed by Alex Mandel and performed by Alex and the Snap Judgment Players, Tim Frick and David Brand. Big love to our partners over at KLW. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting has been there and done that. WBEZ in Chicago, PRX, the Public Radio Exchange, not ERP, the Exchange Radio Public, PRX.org. And even though this is not the news, as much as they want to make it the news, as much as we refuse to be the news, even though if Snap and the news accidentally wandered into the same time portal, even then you would still not be as far away from the news as this is. But this is NPR.
Thank you so much, San Francisco.